Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So we're looking at the fifth way, Thomas's fifth way of, as he puts it, proving the existence of a God. Right? It's the shortest of his ways. They're all very short. I'm sure most of you have looked at them, right? They're very short. They're kind of very compressed. I think they're really more like sketches of proofs than full-fledged proofs. You sort of have to fill them in. But let's just jump in. Has everybody got the handout? This is the fifth way here. And I'm just going to kind of walk through it and make some comments about it. And then in the last section, I'll talk a little bit about the relationship between the fifth way and Darwinism. Okay? So let's just begin. He says a fifth way by which it can be proved that a God exists is gathered from the government of things. That's the word he uses, gubernatio, the government of things. Elsewhere, he explains that to govern means to direct something's activity toward a goal or toward a purpose. That's what it is to govern. So his whole aim here is to help us see how certain things in the world engage in purposeful activity. They're going toward a purpose. And to help us see that this implies that they are subject to a governor, and a governor that we can really recognize as divine, as a God. Okay. I think it's really interesting. He's going to focus on certain things in the world. He's not going to ask us here to look at the world as a whole. Say, look at how beautiful the world is, or how orderly the world is, or something like that. He knows that kind of an argument. That kind of argument has been around for a long time. He even uses it himself in other places. He says the world is like a very orderly household, and that kind of shows that there's somebody in charge, okay? Somebody in charge of the home. Okay? But that's not the argument here. The argument starts from what he says in number two on the handout. We see that some things that lack cognition, namely natural bodies, work for a goal. So he's focusing on just on that class of things. It's a big class. Okay? Includes rocks and water and plants and all sorts of things. But it's not everything. It's not the whole world. Okay? It does not include human beings. Doesn't include other animals, because other animals have cognition. Right? Cognition is either, for Thomas, it's either intellect or sensation. And he thinks only human beings have intellect, but other animals have sensation. Right? So he's not interested in that. Even other animals act for things that they themselves sense or perceive. Right? And he wants us to focus on the activities of things that have no understanding of what they're doing and no perception even. And no sensation. He wants us to focus on that. Okay. Now, that's what he wants to show, first of all, is that they do act for goals. Right? And here it gets a little bit complex. So I've divided up the next sentence, right, the sentence here, into two parts. I think if we break it down, it's easier to get the idea. He says, some things that lack cognition, namely natural bodies, work for a goal, which is shown by the fact that, first of all, let's just focus on this. Always, or for the most part, they work in the same way. We'll just stop there for a moment. That's not the whole sentence, actually. But let's just stop there for a second. Up to this point, I think it's, what he's saying is something that very few people would deny. Right? All he's saying is that there's regularity in nature. Right? There's kind of, you know, he doesn't usually talk about laws of nature, and maybe physicists don't want to do that now either, but there is regularity. Right? Things of the same kind tend to act in pretty much the same way. Right? And rocks tend to fall, right? Trees tend to grow, and so on. Right? And if there weren't tendencies in things, right, there just wouldn't be natural science. Right? If everything were just totally random, right, there couldn't be any kind of science. If acid were just as likely to turn the litmus paper blue as red, right? Well, the litmus test would not be any kind of a test at all. Right? It wouldn't work. Right? Some tendencies fail, right? He says always are for the most part. Sometimes the thing has a tendency, but the tendency fails to be realized. So a seed, you know, an oak seed, it's got a tendency to grow into an oak tree. It might fail, right? Why does it fail? Because it coincides with something else that prevents it, typically, right? So the seed, instead of falling to the ground and growing into a tree, it gets eaten by a bird, all right? So it never becomes a tree. All right, that's fine. That's chance. Thomas calls that precisely chance. Chance is a coincidence of things that have their own tendencies that leads to some result toward which at least one of them was not tending, right? So it happens to that thing by chance, right? And he doesn't deny that at all. Thomas is quite happy to acknowledge that there's a lot of chance in the world. There's all kinds of coincidental events that produce a result that nobody was aiming at, right? But he thinks that chance presupposes tendencies in things, right? The seed is tending to become a tree. Well, the bird has a tendency too. The bird has a kind of tendency that's called hunger, right? Hunger is a sort of tendency as well. And that leads the bird to eat the seed, right? So there's another tendency involved, and they can come into conflict, right? But there are tendencies. So that's the first very fundamental point. There are tendencies in things. Okay, but now he wants to pin down the tendencies that interest him, and that's number three on the handout. They work in the same way such that they reach that which is best, whence it is plain that they arrive at the goal not by chance, but out of a tendency. Okay? So this is a little bit more controversial. That the tendency is not just any old tendency, any old regularity, but a tendency toward the best. Okay? Now, Thomas himself knew of thinkers who would deny that, okay? thinkers who would grant that there are kind of laws of nature or physical tendencies, but things are not going toward anything that's particularly good. They just do what they do. Well, now, he's got to insist on this, though, if he wants to get his result. His result is that there's got to be an intellect governing the show, right? An intellect governing the tendencies. And one of his fundamental principles is that intellect, mind, if it produces results, if it acts for a good. Right? That's a characteristic of intellect. To act intelligently is to act for a good. Right? He just kind of takes that for granted. And I think we can sort of understand that. A tendency, you know, a movement which is not toward a good, there's kind of a lack of intelligibility in that. Right? It's not so intelligent. You know, if a friend of yours does something that you think he's going off in the wrong direction, he's going off in a bad path, right, in a harmful way, you might tell him, hey, don't be stupid. Right? It's not intelligent. It's not smart what you're doing. Right? If it were smart, it would be for a good. Right? So Thomas has to show that things are acting for goods. That's the only way he's going to get to an intelligence running the show. Now, it can happen that a thing acts without intelligence, acts even stupidly, and by chance gets a good result. That can happen once in a while. You might get lucky. You know, suppose somebody gives you a bow and arrow, and you know nothing about archery. You start playing with it, and you happen to hit the target once. Well, that could happen. But if you keep hitting it again and again and again, right, after a while, people are going to say, well, that's not just luck. Right? There's some explanation for that. Even if you do fail once in a while because, you know, it's a difficult feat or there may be obstacles, another point would be if in each case you've come as close to the target as you could. Maybe you're not very good, but it's clear, you know, the arrow is kind of always going over in that direction. Right? It's never going in the opposite direction. You're doing the best you can. Well, even in that case, it's clear that you were really aiming at the target. We could see that. We could see that you're aiming at the target, even if you don't hit it very often. You could tell that the person was doing that. He was doing his best. This is what St. Thomas is saying here, that the way in which things usually act, the way in which they tend to act, tends to yield what's best for them. At least is going in that direction. It's going in the direction of what's best for them. It's they're doing their best. They're doing what's in their power to achieve their good. And that means for him that, well, there really is that tendency in them. They generally do that. They usually do what's usually best for them, given what they can do. And so they're not just getting lucky. There is a tendency there. There's a lot of questions we can ask about this, it seems to me. One is, what is this good that they're aiming at? Right? And he doesn't spell it out here. This is why I say this is kind of just a sketch of proof. Right? He doesn't spell it out. For all the five ways, there are other places in his works where he spells out the same argument in much more detail, and you really need to go to those other places. Here, I think the place to go is his commentary on Aristotle's Physics. He spells it out quite a bit more. The good that he's talking about here is certainly not our good. He's not saying that things always, for the most part, they work for our benefit. That's obviously not true, right? Sometimes the elements are not kind to us at all, right? And he knows that. You know, he was afraid. They say Thomas was afraid of lightning and thunder. He would run and hide when there was lightning and thunder. He was afraid of. So it's not that they're working for us. And it's not even in this argument, it's not even that things tend toward the good of the universe as a whole. He thinks that that's true, ultimately, that the way things are set up, it's for the good of the universe as a whole. But that's not his argument here. His argument here, I believe, is that every natural kind of thing tends toward what's good and best for its own nature, for the nature of that thing itself, for that kind of thing. And to put it in Thomas's language, everything tends toward the fullness of being, let's put it that way, that's suited to the kind of thing that it is. And above all, just to the ongoing existence of its kind. Okay? So the oak tree, it puts out seeds to produce other oak trees. And oak trees tend to produce oak trees and keep the nature of oak tree going, right, in existence. And to be doing all the things that oak trees tend to do. He gives some examples in the Physics commentary that show this, that it's the tendency toward the conservation and being of the kind and toward the activities that characterize that kind. And those activities themselves then reproduce that tendency. Okay? There's a kind of a circle. And Aristotle already said that. Nature comes back on itself. Nature is aiming at itself and keeping itself going, keeping the activities going, the activities by which keeps itself going. And he thinks that's fine. That's not a vicious circle. That's just nature. So he says, teeth normally get positioned in a way that serves for taking in food, ingesting food. Right? Your teeth, the teeth normally appear in your mouth. Right? They don't normally appear in other parts. They might once in a while. Maybe they do once in a while, but not normally. Right? Feet usually grow in the best way for walking. These are his examples. Plant roots grow in the way that favor the nourishment of the plant. Foliage protects the fruits. The fruits, of course, they usually contain seeds, and the seeds obviously tend in a very direct way toward the furtherance of the kind, the promotion of the kind, the conservation of the kind. So the idea is very simple. The basic idea is very simple. Natural beings come in various kinds, and there is no kind that does not tend, above all, that does not tend to stay in being. The kinds of things that there are, they tend to promote themselves. They tend to go on existing. And that's a good for them. Existence, Thomas thinks, that being is good, right? To be is good. And in a way, all good is kind of being or the fullness of being of a thing. And things themselves do their best to go on being. Now, when he says best, that's the word he uses here, best, that implies a comparison, right? Best is, you're comparing things. You say, this one is best. So we have to think about things maybe acting in other ways, possibly acting in other ways, and that would be less good. That wouldn't be the best, right? And we can see that because sometimes things do act in a way that's abnormal, right? Act in ways other than the ways they normally act, the way they usually act. And what he's saying is that usually the abnormal is worse, right? Usually. Maybe occasionally an abnormal, an unusual way of acting will turn out better, but for the most part, it turns out worse. So he says, if a foot gets out of its natural position, it does not serve for walking. Right? If your foot is in the wrong place, or if you rupture your tendon or something, you won't be able to walk. How things usually act is usually better for them than any unusual way of acting that they're ever found to be capable of. Right? We could imagine all sorts of things, but I don't think he's talking about what we could imagine, that this is the best imaginable scenario for the oak tree. But the oak tree does what's best for the oak tree compared to anything else it might be able to do, that it might really be able to do, which we see that sometimes it could do, it does do. Okay, so that's the first step, right? There's this tendency toward the good of the kind in each kind of thing. Right? The next step. Now those things is number four. We're already at number four. Those things that do not have cognition do not tend toward a goal unless they are directed by something with cognition and intellect, as the arrow by the archer. So he gives the example of the arrow. I think here we just have to make sure we understand the terms that he's using, especially these terms cognition and intellect. I'll start with cognition. That's a broader term, right? Cognition is kind of a generic term. You have intellect, but also sensation. So I think we can ask two questions. Why does he think, first of all, that there has to be at least sensation in the picture, something like sensation, some kind of cognition to account for this behavior that we see in things that don't have cognition? Okay. Well, let's use his example of the arrow. I think it's really simple. An archer shoots an arrow at a target. Okay. What's the goal there? Well, it's hitting the target with the arrow, right? That's the goal. It's real simple. Okay. So Thomas is saying that the arrow's having the tendency to hit the target, the tendency that's in the arrow, once the archer shoots the arrow is tending toward hitting the target, right? You wouldn't be able to explain that tendency without reference to some kind of cognition. Some cognition that's influencing or that has influenced the arrow. Why not? Well, I think for two reasons. One is the arrow and the archer are over here, and the target is over there. It's very simple, right? They're here, the target is there. The archer, he wants the arrow to hit the target, right? And somehow, by the way that he or she handles the arrow, the arrow comes to have a tendency toward the target. It comes to be moving in the direction of the target, right? So there's, in the archer and in the arrow, there's something that's kind of a function of the target, something that depends on the target. The target is kind of somehow causing what's going on in some way, okay? If it weren't for the target, the arrow and the archer wouldn't be doing what they're doing at all, right? And the target's over there, right? Whereas the arrow and the archer are over here, right? So how is this possible? How is it possible that the arrow be doing something that is a function of the target, but the target is not where the arrow is? Well, it's really obvious, right? The answer is that the archer sees the target. Right? So the target is not in the archer, but it is present to the archer in his eyesight. He's got vision of the target. He can see, he's over here, but he sees the target over there. And so with his eyesight, he can orient, he can aim the arrow at the target. It's very simple, right? But it's just that simple fact, the one that they're separate in reality. You need to put them together somehow. And cognition does that. Sensation does that. Also, if the goal is to hit the target, where does the hitting of the target exist? To start off with, before he shoots the arrow, where is the hitting of the target? It's nowhere, right? It doesn't even exist yet. And yet, what's happening is a function of that, is aimed at that. is aimed at something that doesn't even exist. Right? That's all. Right? How is that possible? Well, again, it's really, the answer is really obvious. It's possible because the archer has imagined hitting the target. He's thought of hitting the target, right? And his thought, that image of just hitting the target somehow influences his movements, and his movements influence the arrow, and how the arrow is going toward hitting the target. So something which doesn't exist is having an influence on things. And Thomas is saying that only can happen through some kind of cognition. The thing itself doesn't exist, but the cognition of it is somehow the thing, a presence of the thing, which has an influence on the result. So we can imagine future events, right, that don't exist yet, but our imagination of them enables us to direct things towards such non-existent events. Right? Okay, that's sensation. Thomas thinks that, you know, you find that in other animals. Right? A dog chasing a rabbit, well, he has to see the rabbit. He's following the rabbit, and he's imagining something. He's imagining something like eating the rabbit, right? And that's what's moving him, right? Moving the dog. Thomas says that's not enough, though. You got to have intellect as well. Sensation is not enough to account for what he's trying to account for here. Why is that? Well, there I think you could give more than one answer. Let me just give one answer here because we don't have a lot of time. And the answer is this. If we have a tendency toward a goal, right, what I was saying before is that that's a function of the goal. The tendency depends on the goal. It's kind of formed around the goal. But it also depends upon the thing that has the tendency. There has to be some kind of proportion. I would use that word, a proportion between the thing that's going toward the goal and the goal. Right? So, for example, the archer, he wants to hit the target, right, with something. He wants to strike the target, whatever the target is. Well, the thing that he uses to strike the target with, it has to be something that can be shot by a bow. Right? And not just any old thing can do that. Right. So when he aims at the target, he doesn't pick up a cheesecake and shoot it at the target. Right. It's not going to work. And he knows that. Right. And he doesn't pick, you know, you could imagine anything. Right. He doesn't pick up he picks up an arrow. An arrow will work. You know, it can be something that the bow can, you know, with the bow, he can aim it pretty accurately at the target and it will go in that direction. Right. So there's a proportion between the arrow and the end that he has in view, a proportion between the means and the end. Right? The arrow is his means of striking the target. That's all. Now, Thomas's view is that a proportion, here we have a proportion that's kind of causing something. The reason why he uses the arrow is the proportion of the arrow to the end that he's aiming at. Right? So the proportion itself is kind of causing what's happening. How is that possible? Well, a proportion is a kind of relation between things, right? For a proportion to have any effect, you have to grasp the proportion. You have to have some cognition of it, but not just any cognition can pick up proportions. You have to be able to make comparisons. Right? You have to be able to see the relation between one thing and another. And he thinks that's the prerogative of intellect. It's intellect that grasps proportions. You know, the English, the Latin word for reason, which is another word for intellect, the Latin word is just ratio, which comes into English as ratio, right, which just kind of means a proportion. Right? The dog doesn't grasp the proportion between what it's doing and the result that it imagines. It just has an instinct to do certain things, and it usually works, right? But grasping the proportion as such is a function of intellect. So this is why Thomas says you have to have not only cognition of some kind, but precisely intellect, to account for the fact that the natural things operate in a way that really is proportioned to the goal, to their own good. They use means that really are effective, right, toward getting the good, and not just any old means. Right? But now at this point, there's a really subtle distinction going on that we should notice. The idea, what Thomas is basically saying is that things like trees, especially, you know, plants, I think we should focus on plants, because those are living things without cognition. They're acting intelligently. The tree is acting in an intelligent way, or the seed as it's growing. It's moving in an intelligent way, but it doesn't have an intellect. It's acting under the influence of intellect. It's acting in a, you know, as an intellect would make it act, but it has no intellect. How can we see that? Why don't we just say, well, there's a little mind in the tree. The tree is thinking about growing in a certain way. Okay? Well, what he's saying up to here is that what shows that it's acting intelligently is that it acts always or for the most part in the same way, and that way is usually what's best for it. Okay? What is it that shows that it doesn't have intellect in itself? I think it's the same thing. That it always acts, always or for the most part, acts in that way. So that it will act in that way even in circumstances in which that way is no good. Okay? It keeps on doing that anyway, which shows that it really doesn't know what it's doing at all. If it had its own intellect, it would adjust to the circumstances and change its way of acting to fit the circumstances, to be proportioned to the circumstance. So let me give an example from that's not a plant or anything. Suppose you set your alarm to go off every day at 6 o'clock in the morning. And you have a purpose for doing that. You want to get to work on time, or you want to get to class on time. It takes you 3 hours to get up and get ready to go. Class is at 9, so you set your alarm at 6. Okay? Or whatever. Now, that's fine. That's good. And that'll get what you mostly wanted to do. But suppose you just leave it at, set at 6, even on the holiday, when there's no class, right? You could sleep in, right? Well, there you have something which is governed by an intellect. The alarm is set by an intellect. But it doesn't know that today is a holiday and that it shouldn't go off today. So if you don't change, it's going to go off even when it's a holiday, and it's going to wake you up when you wanted to sleep in, right? The fact that it keeps going off even when it doesn't serve the purpose, serve any good purpose, that shows that it doesn't have an intellect in it. Okay? And natural things are like that. That's what Thomas is saying. So if you have, suppose you have a cypress tree. You know, they need a lot of water. They grow in swamps, cypresses. Well, if you take a cypress tree and just put it in the desert, okay, it's not suddenly going to adjust. Right? It's not suddenly. So if you have people making too much noise outside, right, somebody will adjust the circumstances, okay, so that we can keep on talking or keep on hearing. Okay? But the tree, a thing without cognition, won't do that. It won't adjust. The cypress tree will not adjust. The individual tree will not adjust to the new circumstances. It'll keep trying to get water the way it always did, and it will die. Okay. That's what happens with things without cognition. They tend to do what, under their normal circumstances, is what suits them to do, right, for their good. That shows that there is an intellect involved. But they can't adjust themselves to exceptional circumstances, which indicates that they don't have the intellect in them. There's a lot of examples of that that we could give. So Thomas can conclude, therefore, there is something intelligent by which all natural things are ordered toward a goal, and this we call a God. So if we've bought the steps of the argument up to this point, can we quarrel with that? Is there any quarrel with that conclusion? If we acknowledge that there's a mind, there must be a mind governing everything in the physical world, is it okay to call it a God? Well, I think there might be an objection, you know, maybe more than one. Mm-hmm. Maybe we have some doubts about the prior steps that I've just gone through, too. I'll raise a couple of doubts about those later. But one thing that might make us hesitate to call this a God, what Thomas has reached here, is something that Thomas himself insists upon, that by the word God, we mean something that's very different from everything in our experience. That's one of the characteristics of what he thinks deserves the name of God. It has to be, it's above all things, he says, it's a cause of all things, and it's different. It's removed from our ordinary experience. It's very different. That's the characteristic of a God, whatever a God is, whatever is a God, right? To be a god is to be in a class by oneself, so to speak. Okay? But the question then is, how really different is this mind that Thomas is talking about here, this governing natural things? How different is it from the human mind? Isn't it kind of just like a big human mind? Right? Isn't this kind of anthropomorphic? That would be the objection. Isn't this God sort of just the human mind writ large? Our minds, we can make a few things. We can rule over a few things like arrows and alarms and robots, right? We can do that, right? Well, we can make them act in certain ways. God is bigger, right? This God, he can rule over a lot of things that we have no control over. But so he's bigger than we are. He's got more power. He's maybe smarter, but it's basically the same thing, okay? It sounds like the famous line by the poet Joyce Kilmer. You ever hear that poem? Poems are made by fools like me, but only God can make a tree. You heard that poem? You heard it as a kid? Okay. Poets make poems. Engineers or computer scientists or somebody makes robots. Right? Professors make lectures. Right? God makes trees. All right. Well, does the mere fact that he makes trees, we can't make trees, okay, mean that we should call that person a god? Okay. Well, I can't make poems either. I'm terrible at it, right? Should I call every poet a god? Just because I can't do that. Okay. Now, professors making lectures is different. Maybe students should treat their professors as gods. You know, that might be a good idea. But it's not just because they can make lectures, right? It's maybe for other reasons. I think this is an important objection, you know, but the answer, I think, is interesting. The answer is, the idea here is not simply that we can't make trees, that God makes trees, and therefore, you know, therefore he really deserves the name God. Thomas isn't saying that only God makes trees. That's not true. Other things make trees too. Trees make trees. That's kind of the point. Trees make trees. Right? They do it all the time. And cows make cows. Right? And dogs make dogs, and people make people. Right? It's called reproduction. Right? We know that. Right? Aristotle says that reproduction is the most natural activity of all. And Thomas agrees with that. And that's right present right here, I think. Especially the phenomenon of reproduction. A tree doesn't know what a tree is. The oak tree doesn't know what a tree is, what an oak tree is. But it makes oak trees, right? And before it makes other oak trees, it makes itself go on being an oak tree, preserves itself in its existence as an oak tree, right? And it does that because even its parts, all of its parts, function in ways that are conducive to its ongoing existence as an oak tree, right? Its parts tend to do what they do and to stay together the way they stay together and to act the way they do. All of its parts are tree-ish, and they act tree-ishly, if I can put it that way. Okay? And this is that tendency toward the conservation of the thing's kind. Right? And that's what it is to have a nature, right? Is to have that kind of a tendency. You know, poems don't make poems. And lectures don't make lectures, thank goodness. Right? And maybe you can program a robot to make other robots. Maybe you could do that. But at least, you know, the parts of the robot aren't robotish, right, by themselves. They're just pieces of metal and whatever else, you know, that are thrown together. They don't share in the nature of a robot. There's no such thing as the nature of a robot. There's just no such thing. Okay? There's only the nature of metal and plastic and so forth, and then the mind that put that stuff together. And here I think his example of the arrow is a little bit misleading, because he himself says elsewhere, you know, when we put a tendency into a thing, it's kind of forced on the thing. The arrow is kind of forced to go in the direction of the target. It's not from within the arrow. The arrow has no desire to go toward the target, right? It's not hungering for the target. We've kind of pushed it in that direction. Whereas what he calls a nature, when you have the nature of a thing, the tendencies that come from the nature of a thing, those are not forced on the thing. They're from within the thing itself. And even the thing's parts, all the parts of the thing, like your feet and your head, you know, they're all tending in the direction of the good of that nature. So they take the nature, the tendency sort of takes root literally in the thing, if I can put it that way. It's integrated into the thing's identity. The thing has that tendency just because it's that kind of thing. We can't do that. We can't put tendencies in things that just constitute the identity of the thing. We can't produce natures. That's what I'm trying to say. This is what Thomas is talking about. We have a mind that makes the natures of things. We can't do that. We can imitate the natures of things. And we can know the natures of things and use them, but we can't directly put into a thing the very nature. Thomas says it would be like putting the art of shipbuilding into a piece of wood so that the wood itself develop into a ship, right? Well, we can't do that. Okay? We have to work on the wood from the outside and make the wood into a ship. Take a lot of pieces of wood and make them into a ship. We can't put shipbuilding itself into the wood. If we could do that, that would be something divine. God can do that. The idea then is that this is a very different kind of intellect. It's an intellect that can cause the natures of things. Natures in this sense of the word nature. So Thomas is saying there's a mind that causes natural tendencies, causes natural things to cause their own effects, right? He causes trees to make trees, so to speak. He causes this power of reproduction. The idea, it's summed up in a phrase that Thomas uses, a lot of other medieval authors used. It's very lapidary in Latin. It's opus naturae est opus intelligentiae. A work of nature is a work of intelligence. Now, that sounds like a really simple idea based on what we just said. Okay? Work of nature, a product of natural processes, is a work of some intelligence. Okay? But I think it's actually very different from a lot of arguments that are sometimes confused with the fifth way. Okay? A lot of times, the kind of argument that you get is that nature is out there, nature does some stuff, and then God comes in to finish it off. God brings it to completion. Okay. So, you know, this is a very typical kind of argument that you've got. It goes back several centuries, and I think you see it reproduced in some of the arguments that are called intelligent design. But there was a famous philosopher in the 18th century, a guy named Paley, who said that the world is like a big clock. Right? So nature, you've got the materials there. Nature provides the materials. Right? If it were a clock, you know, it would be the glass and the metal and whatever other pieces of stuff you need. And then the clockmaker has to come and finish it off and turn that stuff into a clock. Right? So nature works up to a point, and then the divine clockmaker finishes it off. Well, in that scenario, it's not true that a work of nature is a work of intelligence. You have the work of nature prepares for some work of intelligence. And that's just the way the human mind works. That's the way our art works, right? Nature, we find the natural materials, and then we apply our intelligence to them, and we produce certain results. We make clocks and robots and things like that. And I think a lot of times what's called intelligent design is often that kind of an argument, that nature is great, but there's a little fine-tuning that's going on, right? And that for that fine-tuning, you need a mind, right? So the mind explains the fine-tuning, right? Well, that's not Thomas's argument at all. In fact, he thinks that natures themselves, natures can produce very finely tuned results. Right? The nature of any organism is a very sophisticated thing for him. Right? The nature of it. Right? It's not just you've got a mind doing something sophisticated in this natural stuff. It's the nature itself is very sophisticated. But a mind ultimately is causing all of that sophistication. The point would be even the simplest things for Thomas, even the simplest materials, depend upon a divine mind, because even those have a certain tendency toward their own good and toward their own being. Even the simplest things tend to go on being, right? And even that tendency can't be explained without reference to a mind. So it's a very different kind of argument. And it's an argument for a very different kind of mind from the human mind. So I think we can see on this basis that the God of the fifth way is not just the human mind writ large, it's something quite different. Of course, you know, Thomas says that he thinks that the human mind is kind of an image of the divine mind. It's an imitation. Our very minds are kind of imitations of the divine mind. That's our nature, right? Is to work in a way that imitates the way the divine intellect works. But it's only an image. It's not a mind of the same kind. It's only an image. So that's the argument. I'm sure there are a lot of objections or problems with the argument as far as it goes. But I've just laid out the argument. Now let me say a couple of words about Darwinism. Okay. Now I'm not an expert on Darwinism or evolution or anything like that. And I'm not going to try to suggest that every version of Darwinism, there's a lot of different versions of it, okay? I'm talking about natural selection, basically. That every version of it is totally compatible with St. Thomas's thought. But I want to say that there is a fundamental compatibility, at least with the way Darwinism is usually understood. Let me address two things. One question that is really something that Darwinism only just kind of presupposes, right? And it's not where the explanatory aspect of Darwinism comes in, is kind of just a fact about the history of the world, right? That over time, some kinds of living things have come into being, and then they've gone extinct. Right? There seems to be a lot of evidence for that. Right? I'm not going to challenge that evidence. Right? Now, that might seem like it's an objection to the fifth way, right? That things act for what is best. You'd think, well, if they were acting for what is best, they wouldn't have gone extinct. Right? They would have stuck around. Right? They didn't do what was required for their own conservation, right? Which is exactly what I'm saying Thomas thinks that things are doing. Extinction is what's worst for their conservation. It's not what's best. It's what's worst. I think that can be answered pretty easily, though, that objection. Extinction is the worst for a species, but that doesn't show that the kind wasn't doing its best to survive. All it shows is that its best wasn't good enough. Right? And that's another question. You can have an intelligent tendency, a tendency toward the good, that can fail, right? That can fail, that's all. And the idea is that, you know, God could have perfectly well foreseen that, right? He doesn't have to put all of his wisdom into every one of his works, right? He could have put a little bit of intelligence into something, enough for it to function for a while, and then circumstances change, and the thing can no longer survive. Thomas thinks it's perfectly fitting that God allows some things to fail. In fact, he thinks that's perfectly reasonable. There would only be a real objection if it turned out that some kinds of things don't truly do the best they can to survive, given the capacities that they have. Okay? If it turned out that they positively aim at their own extinction, okay, or fail to avoid it. So I don't know if you've ever seen, there's an old Far Side cartoon, which has it, the caption is, "The real reason why dinosaurs went extinct." You ever see that one? And it's got them all standing around smoking. Right? That's the real reason. Now, that would be a problem for the fifth way. If that were true, it would be a serious problem for the fifth way, because it would mean you've got natural things acting contrary to their own good, directly contrary to their own good. And we, of course, we laugh because it's absurd, right? Only human beings do that. Only human beings intentionally do things that go directly against our own well-being, right? Oddly enough, it's the only natural beings in the world that can act really stupidly are the ones that have intelligence. Right? That's kind of a strange fact, but it seems to be the case. Right? But let's think about the Darwinian theory for a minute. Darwinism offers an explanation for the appearance and the disappearance of living forms over time. Right? that explanation can seem like it's a difficulty for the fifth way. One, at least one of the difficulties is that the thesis is that the way in which new forms come into being is largely a matter of chance, right? By chance mutations, random genetic mutations, right? Many mutations produce kind of monstrous results or useless results or less viable results. But occasionally they do give rise to what are enhancements of the kind and features that increase a kind's aptitude for survival. And maybe over time, there's even it really becomes a new species, right? Now, the theory readily grants that once the kinds are up and running, the better adapted forms survive simply by doing what they naturally tend to do, right? But there was no tendency toward getting them up and running in the first place. There was nothing aiming at the coming into being of that kind, right? That's the objection. The coming into being of the kind was just luck, right? Just a random mutation, right? No intelligence at all. You know, Friedrich Nietzsche goes so far as to say that one of the underlying principles or assumptions of Darwinism is that nature always acts as stupidly as possible, right? That's Nietzsche says that. Now, I don't think that's quite fair to Darwinism, right? But I don't think that this is really much of an objection to the fifth way. On the contrary, Thomas is perfectly happy to grant the existence of chance and coincidence. He insists on it. He thinks that it's under God's providence. That's another question, how you place chance under God's control and under God's providence. But in the fifth way, he's simply not talking about what happens by chance. He's talking about the fact that there are tendencies in the natures of things. That's all. He's not saying even anything about how those things came into being in the first place. He's just not addressing that, whether they came into being by chance or by some other way. He's only saying that the kinds of things that there are, when they are, they tend toward their own conservation. They tend toward their own conservation. The fact that chance results of their activity, results toward which they do not tend, sometimes constitute the beginnings of new kinds or better kinds, that's irrelevant, right? It's just as irrelevant as the fact that sometimes the chance results of their activities are detrimental to them. The fifth way, he doesn't care how the things came into being in the first place for the purposes of the fifth way. He doesn't care. It's only what they do once they're there, how they behave once they're there. And he's saying that they do the best they can. Right? That's all. And it seems to me Darwinism says the same thing. Right? Darwinism takes for granted that the kinds of things that there are tend toward their own conservation. It takes that for granted. Right? It takes reproduction for granted. Right? You know, they don't use the expression struggle for survival anymore. I don't think they use that much. And it never was really a struggle, right? It's not that one kind is trying to get the advantage over another, you know. But suppose a Darwinist looks at the bones of some extinct kind. He finds some bones and he sees that they had jaws and that they had teeth. Let's suppose that. Isn't he not going to suppose that they actually use their jaws and use their teeth to eat? Right? I think he's going to suppose that. Right? They had that, and it would help them to survive, right? He's not going to ask, when he asks, how did they go to extinct? How did they go extinct? He's not going to think, well, maybe they went on a hunger strike. Right? That's not going to be one of the possibilities. Right? He's going to think they were doing the best they could, and the circumstances weren't propitious for them. Right? So this is how I want to say that Darwinism is fundamentally compatible with the fifth way. Right? To the extent that the theory of natural selection assumes this very, very elementary fact, that is the tendency in living kinds toward their conservation in being, to that extent it fits quite comfortably within the fifth way. Right? The only difference is the fifth way sees that tendency extending to everything, not just living things, but all things. Right? So Thomas, his vision is broader. The scientists take that tendency for granted. Thomas, the philosopher, he's urging us to look at that tendency and see how such tendency can possibly exist. And he thinks that points to a mind that has the care over everything, as he calls it, the provider of all being, right? And that is something that I think we can agree anybody would call a God. So that's it. That's all I have to say. That's my answer.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.